It was a sunny summer morning when Johnny Pumpkins opened the door to his house and peered outside. His ma had told him to wear a jacket if he went out, but it was too warm for that. And he wasn't going far, just for a little stroll in the woods that abutted his home. He grabbed the snack bag of leaves and twigs from the kitchen table, tugged on his favorite baseball cap, then latched the door behind him and toddled down the walk to the path that led off into the forest. A light wind blew through the trees, ruffling his hair and invigorating him. What a fine day it was for a walk in the woods! Maybe he'd have another adventure today. The carpet of pine needles that lined the forest floor crunched slightly underfoot, and a familiar aroma wafted up from it. He sniffed. It smelled just like Ma's room air freshener. The trees gradually thinned, and Johnny walked up to a big, flat rock that was in the middle of a sun-dappled clearing. He called it his magic rock. Sure enough, the moment he sat down on it, two little bunnies magically appeared from nowhere and approached him. They wrinkled their pink noses. Johnny Pumpkins returned the wrinkle. A form of interspecies communication followed that no one save the young lad was privy to. All three of them suddenly hopped up into the air in unison. Then the bunnies rolled over, laughing and laughing. Johnny Pumpkins twitched his nose as if to say, "So long."
So long.
Then he got up from the rock and continued on his way. The overhead leafy canopy was denser here, and the woods were correspondingly darker. Another breeze sliced through the trees, but this one was cold and slightly ominous. The youngster shivered. But then he happened upon some other forest creatures that were also his friends. He stopped to watch Mr. Squirrel gather an acorn into his mouth and scurry up a tree. Nearby, Mrs. Bird chirped and chirped as she pulled a worm out of the ground. Then she flew up into the same tree where her nested chicks clamored for breakfast. Oh, gosh, it was so good to be, here in the woods. But would Johnny Pumpkins have felt so cheery had he known that a huge, savage tapir, attracted to his leaves and twigs, was stalking him at that very moment? Probably not. So let's not ruin his day by warning him. Instead, let's return to his home where Mother Bumpkins was hosting a house party. A group of her girlfriends were seated in the living room engrossed in the presentation of Mrs. Fibonacci, a consultant for the Stepford Corporation.
"And in conclusion,"
she said, absent-mindedly smoothing her apron,
"I guarantee that once you begin following the Stepford plan, and I mean religiously, your husbands will begin to pay more attention to you. Mitzi, you had a question?"
An attractive young woman in a yellow chemise piped up in a small, shy voice.
"You said all we had to do was run our tap water through the Stepford filtration unit. But Mo, my husband, is a plumber, and he noticed something different just right away."
Mrs. Fibonacci smiled patronizingly.
"I can't do a smile sound."
"Yeah, grit your teeth."
"Okay.
That does it."
"And that's the purpose of these keffiyehs that I've handed out to you all."
She held hers up.
"It may look like an ordinary Arabian headscarf, but its circular metal band contains a tiny transistor radio that implants hypnotic suggestions in the brain of the wearer as he sleeps. All you have to do is slip it over your husband's head at night, and Stepford will do the rest."
Examining her headband, Mother Bumpkins discovered a row of minuscule speakers in the lining that buzzed ever so faintly when she touched them. Like that, Mrs. Fibonacci motioned for her to hold the band up to her ear. Mother Bumpkins did so. As she listened, she broke into a grin that had just a touch of venom to it. She nodded at Mrs. Fibonacci, who returned the malicious smile. Ruth, in a pretty blue dirndl, liked what she'd heard.
"Well, you can count on me."
"Or count me in.
Oh, you can count me in, too. You can count me in. You can count any way you want. Just give me those keffiyehs and dirndls.
She said emphatically.
Emphatically. I agree. Yeah. Count me right there in.
The other six women readily agreed to sign up for the program, too. Only Jim, brilliantly disguised as his mother-in-law, Blanche, sat stonily in his chair. He had to report this ghastly plot to the village men's club pronto. They might not believe him, so he'd take the keffiyeh as proof of the conspiracy. But as he tried to pocket it, he realized too late that his dress didn't have any pockets. Too late because Mrs. Fibonacci had observed his surreptitious action and was now regarding him with suspicion.
You mean I don't get to do...
What?
I don't get to do that Monty Python sort of Life of Brian thing with the low voice, high voice. You didn't write any lines for Jim?
Oh, well...
What's wrong with you?
Jim was a silent sort.
Gosh. Silent and surreptitious sort. Mm.
He reached up to wipe away a bead of sweat. Here, you can do this. He reached up to wipe away a bead of sweat that had collected on his brow and noticed with alarm that some of his foundation had come off with it. But then Bernice chose that moment to ask a question of the Stepford consultant. With Mrs. Fibonacci's attention diverted, Jim saw his chance to escape. Politely excusing himself to Shirley, he shuffled unsteadily on his high heels toward the door. He almost made it. His hand was on the knob when Mother Bumpkins suddenly loomed in front of him, barring his way.
Blanche,
she hissed.
You don't seem to be on the same page with the rest of us. Maybe you need a little convincing.
And suddenly, Jim found himself pinned to a chair by five pairs of strong arms as Betty, his own wife, firmly pushed the altar keffiyeh down over his head. Suddenly, from deep in the woods, Mother Bumpkins heard a blood-curdling roar. It sounded like a taper. But, of course, tapers were native to Brazil and Sumatra. Surely they wouldn't be around here. There followed a scream of such horror that she couldn't be sure if it was man or beast had made it. For sure, it didn't come from this 526th episode of Calvus and Damien's New Music Bazaar, because today's screams originate from a guest whose ululationary tendencies remain steadfastly horror-free. Just ask the taper, or Calvus.
Taper? I'm not taping. The machine's
not,
taping.
Not Mark Taper?
Oh, that taper.
That forum. You can have a forum on him.
What? What are you talking about?
I'm not talking. You're talking. Well, am I?
I have no idea. I have no idea whatsoever.
This is perfect taper music. What is it?
Well, it's a combination of two pieces, as usual, ever.
Another Calvomix.
Yes, it's a combination of Michael Mannion's brand new CD that we're wrecking, called Music for Solo Vibraphone, from this year, and then Christian Banaschek's electroacoustic piece, Glass Cutter.
When Christian Banaschek was in Hanover? Or Cambridge?
No, wrong one.
Oh, wrong.
That's Wolf.
Ah.
And not Taper.
No.
You said something about, what did you say? Something about, you said something at the end.
Oh, right,
about,
we have a guest with ululationary tendencies.
That's right, I knew you'd said something exactly like that.
Was this not true?
No, it's true. Here, let's hear what she has to say.
The Calvos and Damien Show.
See, she says ululation.
Oh, wait, do that again. Can you?
Well, no, I can't.
Oh, all right.
But I can do this. Yes,
wow, that's us.
Pamela Z. Yes, indeed. And she's our guest today on the show. See, ululation, you ask for them, you get them. And not much else.
No.
We've got more of that and more of everything today, but we have to get started soon.
Yeah.
Because it's a long interview.
We have a speed control, you know.
Yes. I keep forgetting that. We used it to great effect last week. I haven't listened to that show yet.
It's not
posted on the site because we've been a tad busy with the Vermont Composers Festival and such. Do you have any announcements to make before we get started?
Oh, well, if anyone is in the Montpelier Burbs tomorrow, prior to the fireworks, which occur at 9:30, there's a concert by the Vermont Youth Orchestra between 8 and 9:30 on the State House lawn. Amongst the pieces played will be three that were played last September in Carnegie Halle. Among them, Urban Renewals by Well, modestly.
By Damien.
Yeah,
and,
right.
In his real name.
Yes. And then a piece by Trey Anastasio, who has not been on the program, and Troy Peters, who has been on the program.
Right. And Troy's been on twice, and Trey has not been on at all.
I guess that
having
might.
Abandoned us once again.
Again.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So that's tomorrow, Sunday.
And it's free.
July 3rd, 2005, lest somebody should be listening to our archives and head over there from Wyoming.
Exactly.
Or California.
And speaking of Wyoming, if you're coming along, this will be the 12th performance of that piece by them, which makes it a war horse, so bring your saddle.
Oh, yeah, where are the royalties?
They come
okay.
as cap, thank
just
you.
Just checking.
Yeah, it does come in the form of a check.
Ah, all right, then. A minute and a half more of Michael Mannion's
We're not ruining his piece, are we?
I'm doing my best.
Yeah.
He once complained that we always talked over his pieces, so I've made it a point to play them only during the essay.
Makes sense.
All right, let's listen to the last minute
you
of
wanna, change
Michael
speed?
Mannion's music for solo vibraphone. A little speed change? We can do that.
Ah.
There you go. Michael Mannion's music for solo vibraphone. Brand new. Just came in the mail the other day.
Well, it's for solo microphone and chat over.
Vibraphone
and chat over.
And microphone.
And microphone and chat over.
Michael Mannion, Brian Johnson.
Michael, micro.
You and me will be.
We will? Oh, yeah?
Performing in Europe this fall.
Oh, yes.
In October. Assuming things work out well. I did a grammatical there, and I couldn't recover it. There was no way I could turn that one case into another case.
Exactly.
In time. So,
mm-hmm.
Oh, well. Yes, we are. Us are.
We stretch the grammatical rules here.
Yeah, yes, we do.
And the ululationary.
Oh, speaking of which, shall we head off?
I think we
better. Yes, we shall. I should say that since we have about 30 seconds left to explain this, Pamela Z was supposed to be performing today live in Studio Z. Instead, mm-hmm. she performed, shall we say, at time delayed in her own Studio Z in San Francisco.
Yes.
And we recorded our end, she recorded her end, and mailed it to us.
In the wrong
However,
format.
It was in a format we couldn't read, so that she then uploaded the rest of it. And because it was compressed slightly, it was also slightly out of time sync, which means I then had to chop it into little pieces to resynchronize it. This has been the... And the whole reason for this, that she hasn't showed up, is that she is presently at a wedding rehearsal in Hyde Park because her family wouldn't let her come to the radio show because it was rude not to go to the wedding rehearsal just because it was her brother.
Right.
I don't understand that.
Mm.
All right, 30 seconds is up. Let's go to the Studio ZK from Pamela Z and Calvo's home, where we all sort of sat around and recorded each other in a kind of a, I don't know, it's almost sort of a semi-erotic way to have all those microphones around in different parts of the country.
It certainly was surreal.
It was that.
Uh-oh.
What?
What? Who? What? Okay. How?
We lift off.
Lift off what? Ah, that would be the part of my foot that I've been holding on to. The thruster, it's near the Achilles tendon.
Indeed it is.
Indeed, and indeed it is Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar.
Yes, and it's really interesting because we have promised our audience for weeks that
our guest, Pamela Z, would be in Studio Z. And in fact, she is.
Well,
her
so to
Studio
speak.
Z, oh, Studio true. Pamela Z.
Oh, right. And we've always thought we run the gamut of interviewing composers from A to Z. And some years ago, Calvos interviewed van der A, but in Swedish they pronounce it van der A. Isn't that right?
Or it might be Dutch, but close enough.
Oh, Swedish, ah. Dutch, they're all alike.
Yes, they're short words.
You're Swedish, are you not?
Well, I'm Swedish in that I like to shop at IKEA.
Ah, yeah.
So that's what makes me sort of, kind of, I guess.
Yeah. Of course, we're all, well, Calv, I don't think, has partaken of the...
Capitalized letters in that word. I just can't deal with them. They're just too large. They intimidate me. Pamela Z, welcome to Calvos and Damien.
It's so nice to be here.
Is it really?
Well, it's so nice to virtually be here.
Of course.
It's virtually nice to be here.
We're going to start the usual way. Tell us about yourself. Tell us about the encapsulated biography of Pamela Z. Where from, where to, and why?
Especially why.
But why is the hardest part? Actually, my brother's name is Y. My name is Z.
Oh.
But so as to the why, I don't know. But the Z of it.
Can you get your brother? We could ask him about his why.
Well, you would be able to if this were less virtual and more actual. But But that doesn't really make any sense to anybody but me. So maybe I shouldn't say that.
Very good.
So let's see. Let's Z.
Yes.
I was born in Buffalo, New York. No, that's not what you really wanted to know, is it?
Well, that's a good start, but then we can go from there.
You probably want me to leap maybe over a few years.
Leap over the infancy, the diaper training, and all those things.
Unless you did some really creative things out of the diaper pail.
I don't recall them, but I'm sure I did.
Yeah.
Let's leap to when I was in elementary school.
Okay.
And my first sound piece that I can remember is my sisters and I on our way home from school used to find these little pods from a tree that would fall and sort of dry, and when you pick them up and shake them, they were very maraca-like. And
so we
used to play
pods.
Them as little percussion instruments. And my very first public performance, I was 5 years old, and my sister was 7, and we were in our elementary school's talent show. And we sang La Cucaracha, and we choreographed a little dance to go with it and shook our little tree pods as...
Did you get in trouble from the arborist?
We did not.
Oh, good.
Pre-arborist.
And then if you zoom forward from there, you come to when I was still in elementary school or maybe it was when I was in junior high school. You know, I'm afraid that there's going to be some geek on the radio who's going to actually try to figure out how accurate my timing is if they figure out like my date of birth and like when certain things were invented and so on and so forth. But so I might get myself in trouble if I give wrong dates. But I believe it was when I was in junior high school that the cassette recorder was invented.
And by a company audience,
called that would
Craig.
Be about 1960.
Hmm.
And my father sent my sisters and I two of these newfangled devices, because there were four of us, so we each they sort of like made a share, so we each pair of us got one. But I made the most use of them because I was writing songs, playing the guitar and singing and writing songs, and I started making fake radio shows. And again, the word sound art or radio art, none of those phrases were in my vocabulary yet, but now I look back and realize, okay, I guess I was already starting to do that sort of thing, because I would take one of these little cassette recorders, and it was the kind that, you know, it was sort of like a little flat one with a handle that pulls out of one end and then the four mechanical buttons along the front edge of it, and so you press them down and they go ka-chunk, and you have to hold down the record and the play one at the same time and go ka-chunk, and then it starts recording, and I would... sing or speak one part, and then I would turn on the other one and play back the one I had just recorded while recording myself, and sort of did my own sort of, you know, invention of how to do multi-tracking.
Yeah, you bounce
something that probably every
musician
who ever got their hand on two tape recorders eventually figured out at some point. And I would make entire radio programs where I would do all of the voices. And I'd sing all the songs. I would do all of the announcing. And I'd make fake commercials that went in between and so on and so forth. Are you still there, by the way?
No. We are.
Good.
We are. No, we're not.
What? I just wanted to make sure that, you know, it wasn't you that was trying to call me. Okay,
you,
so...
You want to take that call?
No, I don't.
Can you get that party on our line? I mean, we could do our own little radio art.
Oh, that's true. I could bring them on, but then I don't think you'd hear them because their voice would be really tiny and just in my ear.
Oh, well, you...
And it would be sad.
The voice in your ear. That sounds like one of those dangerous people that blow things up. The voice in my ear told me.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, that hits a little more close to home than you might think for me, but... I shouldn't say that because that might confuse you. I keep saying things and then saying that I shouldn't say them.
Well, you don't have to. We can edit them, of course.
And you can sing them.
Of course.
Of course.
We were hoping for an introductory ululation pretty soon, but at your leisure.
Okay. At my leisure. All right. I don't know. I might make the Pro Tools might go into the red if I do that. I'll have to back off the mic a little.
Just like the Calvus and Damien bank account.
Yeah, that's and just like my bank account these days. indeed, indeed.
Gotta go.
So this was your first sort of sound art piece, and you are in a sense a child of technology that way.
Yeah, and it's funny. I never really thought about it that way, but people always note that I'm sort of into the technology with what I do, but it never occurred. I hadn't really thought about the fact that it goes back a lot further than one might think. Because I had that technology, the tape recorders, and I also I happen to be the first person I know who ever had an answering machine.
The tape you had to thread through it, that kind?
What's that?
The tape you had to thread through it, the little loop of tape?
Say that again?
The tape you had to thread through your answering machine. The loop of tape.
Oh, the loop of tape. Yeah, my first answering machine actually had, it didn't use cassettes. It used actually had little reels in it. It didn't have cartridges, and it was an old one that I bought at some. I found it at some like weird thrift store or something, and you record your outgoing message on one tape, and then people record their other messages on the other tape, and. All of my friends yelled at me because they said, how impersonal to call somebody's house and get a recorded message. That's just, terrible. And I said, you mean you'd prefer that the phone would just ring and ring and ring and no one picks it up? You can leave a message this way. But they just didn't get it. And then, several years later, it got to the point where one day we reached the point where now if you don't have one, people yell at you. I called your number and there was no answering, device or no voicemail. I just rang and rang. What's up with that? So it's kind of interesting.
So you chose the new technology and the oldest technology in the sense in the voice and brought them together.
That's very true. And in fact, I enjoy the fact that both are very complex technologies, and they both kind of equally contribute to my work. I mean, the way they work with one another is what results in what I'd say the signature of my work, or the actual voice of my voice manifests itself as the combination of the machines and the human voice.
When did you become conscious of the fact that you were actually using the technology as technology? When did you make the leap from sort of a kid having fun with a couple of machines to deciding that you were going to do that as your art form?
There was a huge, huge chasm between those two points. Because between my making fake radio shows and layered sound pieces with my voice and two tape recorders, there was a whole period of me just singing classical music and being a singer-songwriter and doing non-pop. And so I went all through junior high school and high school and college doing what would be considered pretty conventional music compared to what I do now. And while I was in college, I was a music major. I was a voice major. And hang on for a second. I'm going to unplug my refrigerator. I hope you don't mind. hang on.
We've been charged for... No, go right ahead.
Yeah, I'm
I see. Well, we should mention again then to our listeners that our guest today on Calvis and Damien is Pamela Z in her own Studio Z across the continent from Studio A, or are we in Studio K because this is Calvis' building.
Well, of course.
We're alphabet soup here today. And she will actually be in Vermont the very day you are hearing this broadcast, but she will be at a wedding rehearsal. And it seems that for some reasons that we can't understand, the wedding rehearsal came ahead of Calvis and Damien. That makes no sense to me whatsoever.
Oh. We invited the entire entourage into KND's studio, into Studio Z.
We were ready to decorate with the colors and everything.
We had a cake.
They could have gotten married on the radio.
Yes, they still can.
Yeah, so I don't know. Maybe maybe the rehearsal should take place as your show, and then we'd have to figure out how to make it fit in another space later. But yeah, no, that, yeah. Well, this is the week for me of the phantom appearance, radio appearances, being in two places at once. I'm going to be in two places at once twice between the 2nd and 4th of July. Because I just yesterday taped a radio interview that's going to air on our local public radio station on the 4th of July. And now we're doing this one for you, and it's going to air on the 2nd. So isn't that fabulous?
Wow.
I did one after the other, but they're going to air in the opposite order.
This is temporally confusing, so let's
it's
get back
temporally
to you.
Confusing.
Let's get back to your chasm between the toy tape recorders and when you made the discoveries.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm listening to you guys, and I'm realizing you guys seem very confused, and so it seems this is all very appropriate.
Well, we're always confused. This is not new.
There's not news. It's not news to your listeners, is it?
Not at all.
Okay, well, that's good. That's all right. I'll try to guide you along.
Please.
Into my own confusion.
So where were we? Where are we need guidance now.
Yes, I was about to leap over the chasm, wasn't I, when we stopped to unplug the refrigerator. Okay. So leaping over the chasm, I studied music when I was in college, and I went to school at the University of Colorado at Boulder, at the College of Music there, and I was a voice major. And I think, and they keep, when you study music, I don't know if it's still this way, but when I was in music school, you had to take so many credit hours just to get through in 4 years that you didn't have time to really think straight.
Yeah, when I was in school in 66 to 70, it was the same way. There were just an enormous number of credit hours of various applied music and so forth.
And as a voice major, and I suppose this will be the same for an instrumentalist, you had to take choir. So I suppose if you're an instrumentalist, you had to be in band or orchestra or something. But you had to take choir, and you got one credit hour for it, but it had four rehearsals a week. You know, and so there were things like that. And then not to mention voice leading and conducting class and music history and, you know, all these different things that you had to take. So I had this incredibly full, like something like 21 credit hours every semester that I was taking. And I was just sort of like in this sort of undirected way going through music school and studying bel canto style singing techniques with my private teacher at school, and then singing in the chorus, and then taking my history courses and taking doing all this stuff. And it wasn't until like my last year of school that I began to meet these really strange and interesting people. And I found out that all the interesting people were composition majors, and that their instructors were the only instructors at my school that even were aware that there were still any living composers.
Well, let's have some business first then. All right, if we can do that. Pamela, are you there?
I'm Pamela Zed, and you're listening to Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, your one stop for non-pop.
On the Non-Pop International Network. She was actually fooling about the Zed part.
Yes,
right. Just in case, in case you wondered. In case anybody wondered.
There were still 20. There were still 20 seconds on that.
Silence.
Why?
Because I put it there. Because my finger's not that good. And you know where this show is? We have a new legal ID now.
We do?
Yes. You're listening to Calvos and Damien's New Music on WGDR 91.1 FM, Goddard College, Plainfield, Vermont.
That's entirely too much to say. What happened to the nice, easy one?
I don't know. It went illegal or something.
Oh.
Got me.
Okay.
Yes, our guest is Pamela Z, and we're, in order to complete the thought she had earlier, the thing just tried to close on my seat. To complete the thought she had earlier, we're going to play a piece of hers called Geek Speak. And if you'll think back to what she was saying before about the telephone and a few other things, it might come into play in what we hear now. Here's Geek Speak with Pamela Z, after which we'll go right back to the interview.
Bit bod bite, bit bod bite, bit bod bite. bit odd, right?
The basic definition of a geek.
I don't know how to articulate it really, but
jargon geek speak.
I think a nerd is somebody who.
My definition of a geek would be someone who finds.
What I call a geek.
The basic.
Well, nerd's got to be sort of smart or something. How? But a geek is
computer geek stuff.
Word geek.
Oh, a nerd is a language.
I like all that math.
And I refer
stuff.
To as geeking out.
My definition of a geek would be someone who finds a machine or a really esoteric, like, logical to be really fascinating construct and likes to, and understands it, see what its limits are, and see exactly what it entails, play with it, and to the extent that they probably find it slightly more fascinating than conversation with most people.
I don't know how to articulate it really, but the Unix operating system. I mean, when we say PC operating system, we probably
Mac. No question.
Which is a personal computer that came out in the mid '80s.
All the aspects of Unix that people hate.
I've heard good things about Plan 9, though.
I don't know how to articulate it really, but
an incredible piece of cruft.
It's so gross. It's so crufty. It's this big organic
hacks piled on kludges, piled on unstable foundations. Really frightening to look at.
Translate all the computer stuff. All that does is translate all the computer stuff. Mac, no question, originally written as 32-bit ABLE. Didn't have the ability to handle 32-bit data paths in the ROM. The machines had the ability to handle it before the operating system did, and then eventually had to go back and write an operating system to CX, where you have to buy a little enabler patch 32-bit mode. But the way that they've designed the system software is that you can tell the system to not look in the ROM for the information, but to look somewhere else in the system. You know, you just rewrite it in the system, and they change the pointer to where that particular data is. It's physically hardwired into this little piece of information. Is this little piece of information?
There's a couple things. One of them is spamming. I'd be pretty much toast. That's not a good thing.
And when you get the math wrong, you're toast. Get me in a lot of trouble. I would probably toast me.
Another thing that might be good to fry myself with.
Internet protocol. One little teeny control panel, Mac TCP. All that does is just translate all the computer stuff into TCP IP, and then it's done. Bang. You know, things can still try and, like, grab memory space that they're not supposed to be able to grab and collapse the whole thing.
Cool little box that it was so beautiful.
So I sort of missed the boat by not being a composition major because I didn't really get much in the way of a new music education, except for this one, a really amazing professor that I found out is still on the faculty there. His name was Dr. Luring, and everyone thought that he was nuts, and I think he kind of was. But the thing is, he was deeply, deeply interested and dedicated to new music. And he taught the 20th century music class. And he was a terrible teacher. Like, one of the ways that he would teach would be, you know, that we would read, I can't remember whether we were reading the Michael Nyman text or the Eric Zaltzman, but there was this one 20th century music textbook that we would read. And he would should I try to bring this other person into our conversation?
Why not? Yeah.
Okay, let me get them. Hang on.
Our guest is Pamela Z, and she's going to try and bring somebody else into the conversation.
Hello? Hello?
Yes.
Oh, hang on. Okay, now you're on speakerphone. Hello?
We can't hear you.
Oh, who do I have?
Take your pick.
Did I flash?
Yes.
Oh, wait. Hello? Hello? Hello?
I love technology.
Yes, tremendous radio here at Calvis and Damien Studios. Right now, we'll cut away to some music by Pamela Z. We'll be back.
All right. Hello?
Oh, hi, Pamela. This is Dan.
You have reached my automated answering machine.
I hate these clever messages.
After the tone, please leave your name, your number, and a good time to reach you. If you would like to hear about upcoming events, please press 2.
God.
If you would like my web address, email, or cell phone
another
number,
one of those ridiculously
please press
long
3.
Announcements.
If you think this outgoing message is too long and you would like to interrupt it so that you can get on with leaving your own message, please press pound.
Thank God. Oh, hi, Pamela. Geez, I thought I was... It almost sounds like your answering machine read my mind. Anyhow, I was calling about that meeting you were trying to schedule for Sunday. Turns out I can't make it. I have a rehearsal.
That's too bad. I guess we'll have to reschedule.
What? You are there? Now, I thought I was talking to your message machine.
This is the message machine.
But you're responding to me.
Yes. This is a voice-activated message machine. You speak, the machine listens, and then responds accordingly. If you understand this, please press or say 1.
I understand it, but I don't believe it.
I'm sorry. I am unable to interpret your response. If you understand this, please press or say 1.
1.
Excellent. Now...
But I still don't believe it.
I'm sorry. You have only 37 additional seconds in which to complete your message. I suggest that we get back to the business of...
That meeting you were trying to schedule for Sunday?
If you agree, please press or say 1.
Well, gee, all right then. 1. But this, isn't this kind of strange for a personal answering machine to be carrying on a conversation
Excellent.
Like this?
So, in regard to...
That meeting you were trying to schedule for Sunday?
Please hold while I access the calendar. If you are willing to hold, please press or say 4. If not, press or say 5.
Oh, so it's 4 and 5 now?
I believe I detect a note of sarcasm in your voice. If you would like to end this call, you can keep that up. If you would like for me to continue accessing the calendar, please press or say nothing.
Nothing.
The machine will now hang up.
Hello. Back.
Hello.
What? Hello? Who's this?
Hello? Am I still with Calvis and Damien?
You must be.
Okay, so the other person has disappeared. The other person has disappeared. All right, so...
Telemarketers.
I think I might have pressed... When I was trying to press flash, I think I pressed talk. Maybe that's what I did wrong.
Professor of music, was he interested in new vocal techniques? Is that where he first got interested?
No. He was interested in Stockhausen and John Cage and... So in that sense, he was, but he wasn't, like, specifically interested in vocal techniques. And as a matter of fact, I don't remember him particularly exposing us to a lot of new music, new vocal music. It was more just the actual exposure to new music by somebody who took it seriously and believed that it was something to be studied, as opposed to the rest of the teachers at the school who either ignored it completely or would brush over it as the last few minutes of history, you know,
right,
and drop the needle on a couple Stockhausen pieces and then you identify them and then you've learned your 20th century music. But Dr. Luhring was very, very interested in John Cage and all these different things, and he taught about it in his class. He was terrible with actually his lectures and the way he, well, his lectures were crazy and kind of interesting, but his teaching method was to take and Xerox pages out of the textbook and then you know, remove words from them, and then to prove that you had read the chapter, you would fill in the blank that he hadn't, that he'd left open. So it was that kind of thing. Well, there was one day when I was sitting in class, and he was going over the answers on one of those type of quizzes with us. And because he was going over the answers, I assumed, oh, well, then this one isn't going to count. We're not going to have to turn it in. He's telling us the answers. So I sat there, like, going over the answers and looking at it, and I got bored, and so I started doodling on my sheet. And I, at the time, was reading John Lennon's either Spaniard in the Works or In His Own Right, one of John Lennon's two sort of odd novels that he wrote that were written in sort of a strange nonsense language that he had invented called Leninish. And I was very fascinated with those books at the time. So I was reading one of them, and in it was a poem about a guy named Eric Herbel who had a growth on his head. And I was trying to memorize that poem. So I was writing the poem on the top of my, in the margins of my paper. And then the end of the class came, and Dr. Luhring said, all right, everyone, pass your papers up. And I was like, oh, no, I didn't know we had to turn them in. So I went ahead and passed mine up, and then as I walked towards the door, I walked past his podium just as my paper was landing on top of the one that he had in his hand. He looked down at my paper, and without skipping a beat, he began reciting this Eric Herbel poem that I had written half of on the page, starting from where I left off. He knew it by heart. And that's when I realized, okay, this guy has something going on. And then he started expounding about, ah, yes, John Lennon. You know that he was very influenced by the writings of John Cage. And he started, you know, making comparisons between, you know, John Lennon and John Cage, and started talking about Yoko and her relationship to the art world. And I was just like, okay, this guy's pretty interesting. And so that's my Dr. Luhring story. So apparently he's still nuts, and he still lectures, and he does this thing where if he thinks people are getting bored and not paying attention, he'll stop in the middle. This was like years ago before, like I seem to remember the hello thing happening sort of in the 80s. But it was in the 70s when I was in music school, and Dr. Luhring used to do that. When people weren't paying attention, he would stop, and he would look at the class and go, hello, hello, I'm talking up here. And he was quite the odd bird.
And is this your inspiration for your piece, what is it called, the Questions?
Years know, later? It could have been subliminally part of an inspiration for that, but that song was not to be made for many years after that.
You must have seen lots of views out the left window.
How is it ending?
Over the left wing.
How is it ending?
By the time I got your message, you had gone. By the time I got your message, you had gone. By the time I got your message, you had gone. By the time I got your message, you had gone.
How is it ending? How was your trip? Where are you going? What are you having? How is it ending? How was your trip? Where are you going? What are you having? How is it ending? How is
you
it?
Must have
Where are you going?
Last
Where are you
night.
Having? How is it ending? How
you
is
must have
Where
seen
are you
lots of views.
Close
the left
Where
window.
Are How is it ending? How is it
ending?
Over the left wing. How is it ending?
By the time I got your message, you had gone.
How is it ending?
By the time I got your message, you had gone.
How is it ending?
By the time I got your message, you had gone.
How is it ending?
By the time I got your message, you had gone.
How is it ending? How is it ending? Where are you going? What are you having? How is it ending? How is your trip? Where are you going? What are you having? How is it ending? How is your trip? Where are you going? What are you having? How is it ending? How is your trip? Where are you going?
Where are you going? What are you having? How is it ending? So I get out of music school with my music degree. I can sing opera, and I'm a singer-songwriter writing my own songs, and there's no connection for me between the songs I write and the classical music I do. I just know that I like both of them, but I always am wishing that there was some way I could connect them together.
And the word unemployed comes to mind.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny, but I, after almost straight out of college, like for the first year and a half out of music school, I actually taught music in schools for a year and a half. But I quit my teaching job when I realized that I made more money busking on the street than I made was being paid as a teacher.
Well, you were busking by singing during the songs that you were writing?
Playing the songs I was writing with a guitar and having people throw coins and dollar bills into my guitar case. I made more money doing that.
What street? What town?
In Boulder, Colorado, Pearl Street Mall.
Yeah.
And also I had traveled to San Francisco. The first time I ever went to San Francisco, I busked in Berkeley on Telegraph Street and in San Francisco at the cable car turnaround in Fisherman's Wharf. And I found that I was making more money, you know, doing that than I was being paid to teach children in the public school. So I stopped teaching after like a year and a half and just started playing music full time. And I lived in Boulder for 10 years, and for that entire 10 years, I pretty much made my living as a musician. But I was always falling under the criticism of the sort of pop music people who, pop and folk music and rock music, you know, that whole side of the world, were always complaining that my voice sounded too trained. And the classical people were always complaining that, oh, you shouldn't do that other music. It'll hurt your voice. It's bad for your voice. And then, like, towards the last year and a half or 2 years that I was in Boulder, I started running into these new music people. And also there was something happening with the bleed through from punk and new wave into the art music world and the connection between people like Talking Heads mm-hmm. and those kinds of people with people like Phil Glass and those kind of people. And all of this stuff culminated in a world where suddenly singing with a classically trained voice and doing something other than, you know, common practice period classical music suddenly became an option. Like the rules got broken down, and I started to do more experimental things, and that is where I found the connection between the things I had been doing. And I think the real breaking point, and I think this is really the solid edge of the cliff on the other side of the chasm, was the day that I bought a digital delay unit. And my life changed overnight. I came home with this digital delay unit, and I started singing into it and didn't know how to use it, so I just plugged a microphone into it and took an output from it and plugged it into a guitar amp or something. I think I had a little PA system. It wasn't even a stereo PA. It was just like a mono PA that I used to go and play songs in clubs because I played in clubs a lot. So I plugged it into my PA, and I started singing through this thing and making loops. And my poor neighbors probably never got any sleep that night because I wouldn't go to bed. I was
Did you buy this on a whim or on intuition?
What's that?
Did you buy it on a whim or on intuition?
I actually bought it because, now don't laugh, but my sister dragged me to a Weather Report concert. And somewhere in the middle of the Weather Report concert, all the other members of the band left the stage, and Jaco Pastorius sat down on a chair, and he had one of those little 8-second foot switch digital delays.
Right.
And he did a duet with himself, playing the bass. He just improvised a duet, and he just made like a couple of riffs in the loop and then started playing over the top of it. And I said, I don't know what that machine is, but I need that. And so the next day I went out to all these music stores, and I said, I saw this guy like play his bass, and he could like step on something, and then he had recorded it, and then he could play over the what is that? And they said, oh, that's a digital delay. And they said, well, show me where those are in the store. And so the guy showed me where they were, and there were these like little cheesy guitar pedal ones that you could buy, but then there were these nice rack mountable ones that were much higher sampling rate. And he said, if you're going to do it with your voice, you're probably going to want the one with the better sampling rate. And I said, okay, I'll take it. And I took it home, and that was the beginning. That little digital delay, which was an Ibanez D1000, I think it was called, I still own that device. It's I'm afraid to say that it's in a closet gathering dust right now, but I still own it. As a matter of fact, I own two of them because it became such a staple of my work at one point that I bought another one so that in case anything happened to it.
So how long were you using it?
I started using it. And I think for about, like, I think I might have bought it. This is all, oh, I'm getting, like, static here. Is that weird?
I think we're experiencing an electrical storm somewhere around Iowa.
But I guess it's all right because.
Oh, that's
better.
Yeah,
it seems better now. Okay, so I probably purchased that digital delay sometime around 82 or 83, I would say. And overnight, my repertoire changed. In the first night that I had it, I wrote my first digital delay piece, which was called City, and had this loop that sort of repeating loop of me just doing these sort of vocally stuff. And then over the top of it, I sang this, I Wish I Were in the City. And I think it was grammatically incorrect. I wish I was in the city. I think that's how I sang it. It's been so long. Oh, it's so funny. That's like 20 some years ago. Mm-hmm. I made that piece, and the next day, the next weekend, I had a gig and I brought the digital delay. And people were a little weirded out because I put my guitar down and I started making these vocal loops in the digital delay and singing this song. And within the next several weeks, my whole repertoire started being taken over by all these digital delay looping songs. And
And you're in Boulder still, right?
And I was in Boulder. And the Joni Mitchell fans were saying, but you have such a pretty voice. Why do you want to use a gimmick like that? And they just didn't understand where I was going with it. And I realized I could not go back to what I had been doing before. It was really that quick. Like I would say, within 6 months of buying the digital delay, everything I was doing was being radically changed, and I was sort of going to a place where I couldn't go backwards from.
In times of old, in times of old. Why do you talk to me that way? 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 Why do you talk to me that way?
Do you know time, were you aware of anyone else doing this sort of music?
I wasn't aware of anyone doing exactly what I was doing, but I was becoming aware of new music because I had a show on the local public radio station. Is it okay to say call letters of other stations?
Oh,
it is, right?
We encourage it.
I had a radio show at a station called KGNU in Boulder, and my show was called the Tuesday Afternoon Sound Alternative, and so I was experiencing this tremendous disconnect between the music I was listening to and playing on my radio program and the music that I was going out at night and playing to make a living, in that the music I was listening to and playing on my radio station was a lot of, I had found, I just unearthed all kinds of records that, like, from 1750 Arch. And at that time, I wasn't, you know, in the Bay Area, so I didn't know what 1750 Arch was. But for those who are in the know, it is now, that is the address of a place called SynMat in Berkeley, which is the Center for New Music Technology.
Right, and at the time, one of the other vocal people of the world, Thomas Buckner, was involved with that record.
Thomas Buckner and Charles Amerikanian.
Right.
And so Charles had made all these compilations, records, LPs, on, because CDs, we didn't have CDs yet then. It seems kind of odd, but yes, we didn't have them yet. And so I had this huge vinyl record collection that was beginning to be taken over by these weird 1750 Arch recordings that I found. And I think I heard my first Laurie Anderson. It was like pre-O Superman. It was, she did this thing called Closing Time or something. What was that piece called? Time to Go.
Oh, yes.
And it's a piece about the museum, and the guard is telling everyone it's time to go. And that piece, Charles had a very early recording of her doing that, and he made this compilation that had that and something by Ned Rothenberg playing experimental, you know, clarinet techniques.
Right,
and,
yes. We may even
there
have
was Pauline Olivares playing the accordion. So I was getting... there was an Alvin Lucier piece, I think, on that. There was this compilation was like my first, like, real new music education, you know, beyond Dr. Luring at the school.
Now, you don't mention Kathy Berberian in this.
Kathy Berberian came up later for me. This is what's interesting is I was starting my own sort of experimental vocal music practice sort of in a vacuum with no peers because there was no one in Boulder doing that. And I was learning about new music, but the people who were inspiring me weren't necessarily vocal people. I was being inspired by Steve Reich. I heard these recordings, which were doing with, you know, other sounds looping what I was doing with my voice. So minimalism had a huge influence on me because basically minimalism told me that it was okay to become so fascinated with this repetitious stuff that was suddenly so interesting to me. And so, you know, so my first, you know, new music influences were sort of, you know, Steve Reich, Phil Glass, Brian Eno. And the stuff that Brian Eno was doing with David Byrne, that was the other non-Talking Heads projects that David Byrne was doing. And I got all of these recordings from the library at KGNU, and then I started trolling the used music, you know, used record stores for these weird labels that I had come to know would have this stuff on them.
The trolling of the cutout bin.
The cutout bin.
A familiar
looking
experience.
For the, and I was, you know, paying a dollar for like CRI recordings and 1750 Arch recordings of like really pretty priceless stuff that's now not in print anymore.
Right.
And that was sort of my new music education. And after about a year and a half of that, I had to leave Boulder. Because I didn't have really much in the way of a new music community there, and I was really excited about all this stuff, and I needed to go someplace where people were doing it and would appreciate it. And and people were my old fans were mad at me because I was doing electronics and they didn't want that. They wanted me to play pretty songs with chords, you know, on a 12-string guitar. And so I moved to San Francisco. I think it was in 1984. I packed everything into my hippie bus, drove to San Francisco, and I've been here ever since. But when I got here, I was met by an amazing time. I think it was really an amazing time that nothing else is quite ever will ever be quite like it. At that time, Rindy Eckert was doing these theater pieces with the Paul Drescher Ensemble, where Paul would loop Rindy's voice, and Rindy was doing all these bizarre, you know, running around on stage and characters and voices and songs. And Diamanda Galas was in San Francisco a lot at that time and doing and performing at clubs in San Francisco. But your question about Joan LaBarbera and Kathy Barbarian and Diamanda Galas and, you know, Meredith Monk.
Yes, that was a question actually that I asked you several weeks ago.
I didn't know who any of those people were. And I started learning about them, and here's how I learned about them. People would come up to me after a show and say, you must be very influenced by Meredith Monk. And I would go, by who? And they thought I was lying. And so then I would go out the next day and I would go to a record store and I'd say, I'm looking for something by Meredith Monk. And the guy would say, Thelonious Monk? And I'd say, no, Meredith Monk. And then I'd get my hands on a Meredith Monk and I would go home and listen to her and I would say, you know, I see what they're saying.
Uh-huh.
And other people would say, oh, you're trying to sound like Laurie Anderson, aren't you? Now, I did know who she was because she had by that time had a Warner Brothers number. I don't know. I think that Oh Superman at some point was like in the top 10 or something.
Yeah, actually in the UK. I'm not sure if it was here.
But it was getting some pretty heavy rotation, at least on the more progressive radio stations. So I knew who she was. But no, I wasn't trying to sound like her. And I wasn't influenced by Meredith Monk. And I just was doing what came naturally to somebody who's playing with voice and text and making loops of their voice with digital delays. There's a natural progression that happens there. And I think it's a lot like when you go around the world and you go to all these different cultures and they all have certain things in them. They all sort of independently develop those. I think there's a natural thing that comes from working in that way. And certainly Meredith Monk did not work with digital delays. But she did it by working with repetition, by having an ensemble who, you know, would sing these little hockets that she would compose. And I was sort of doing something very similar, but I was singing them myself and then looping them and then creating layers and harmonies and things over them. But, you know, at the time, my work was really quite tonal in a way still. And I think my work has always been pretty tonal, but some cases are less tonal than others. But at that time, I think pretty much everything I was doing was quite tonal, but it was really what was radical about it was that it was taking on this very, minimalist aesthetic of lots of repetition and very, very slow and gradual change of textures through adding more sound. And so through people who would come to hear me play, I began to learn in a sort of backwards way who all the people who were supposedly my influences were. And I learned from Charles Amerkanian and his, he used to do this series called Speaking of Music, which then he did this thing in Telluride every year that was the Composer to Composer Festival, and which I think now the sort of modern day version of that is the Other Minds Festival in San Francisco. Yeah. But I would go to these events that Charles would put on, and I would learn about, you know, Morton Subotnick and this amazing singer that he was married to, who would do this piece called Jacob's Ladder.
Ladder.
And walk circles, ever widening circles around on the stage while intoning these sounds, and then, you know, I started getting old recordings of Kathy Berbarian and all these people, and I learned about this legacy of people working with voice in experimental ways.
Thank you.
You didn't come from it from the point of view of, it sounds to me like you were breaking away, and as some of the other composers have told us, the taking ownership of your vocal instrument from the sort of male-dominated compositional world.
Well, it's interesting because when I first started doing experimental music, I was so naive of the field that I didn't even know to know that it was male-dominated. And it wasn't until I got to the Bay Area where there was a real new music community, and I found myself amidst, there were women. I mean, I think there's some amazing women, especially in the Bay Area. I mean, there's like Maggie Payne, was at Mills, and still is.
And still is, yes. She was on our show last year.
And there's, you know, there were a lot of people doing interesting things, women, but in terms of just like the rest of society, the electronic music world, and especially because the electronic music world is really kind of like a sort of a branch of the geek world, and the geek world is definitely dominated by white men, right? But, you know, even when that wasn't completely the case, because there always have been Pauline Oliveris, Laurie Spiegel, you know, these people have been around, but if you would go out and buy a new music compilation, there would often be no women on it. And when I started to get a little bit better known and I started being included on some of these new music compilations, usually I was the only woman on them. I was also the only person of color on them. Mm-hmm. But I have to tell you, I was so distracted by the world and my excitement with what I was doing that I kind of didn't really pay that much attention or care that much. And it had to be pointed out to me by other people. And I also, in those days, used to get this thing where, you know, I developed my own system of working with digital delays, and I had this stack, like I had a six-space rack that was full of delays and the sampler and, you know, other processors. And I had them all patched through a mixer. I learned by teaching myself because I didn't go to Mills where all these other people were. Right. I was so jealous when I got to the Bay Area and learned that all my friends who were colleagues had all gone to Mills College when I was at Boulder studying with people who barely believe that there's any like living composers. My colleagues were at Mills studying with Bob Ashley and, you know, Steve Reich and people like that. So
is that why you brought a kind of a different and unique color and structure to your stuff? You know, it has a lot of the looping and layering, but I would say that it has a distinctness that is absolutely not characteristic of a lot of sort of music of the era.
Yeah, I think maybe so because I created it in a vacuum kind of, and so it was really influenced by a combination of very odd influences. That is like sort of rock music and rock music and folk music, and then classical music, but like common practice period, like bel canto, like Italian aria, Italian opera,
Vittoria, Vittoria,
you know, type of stuff, and Bach, and so that was really a strong influence in there, and then sort of like just songwriting structure of a person who's a singer songwriter, and then kind of just the idiosyncrasies of my own voice, and what it would do and what it wouldn't do. And what playing with my own instrument revealed, and a desire to sort of like do performance art, because I was like really interested in this intersection of the arts, and I didn't even know if that word interdisciplinary was quite in fashion yet when I first came to the Bay Area, but people were still using the word multimedia.
To mean it was sort of hijacked by computer,
which got hijacked by the computer industry, yeah. But it was still being used to mean art in those days, and so I would talk about doing multimedia performances, and I wanted to combine like text with, vocal sounds and found object noises and visually interesting things, and so it was my just sort of picking up all the little pieces of stuff that I liked that came from popular culture and from unpopular culture and from my own like past, and putting them all together into what I was doing. And it's very interesting because at some point, people were always saying to me, oh, you should listen to Meredith Monk. And then I really became into Meredith Monk. Oh, you should listen to Diamanda Galas, or you should listen to Joan LaBarbera, or Kathy Barbarian. And people would suggest all these vocal people to me that they thought my stuff reminded them of. And one day somebody said, do you know this woman, Amy X. Newberg?
Amy X. Newberg.
And I
yes.
said, I don't. And they said, well, I'm curating a show, and I'd like to have you and her on it because I think you guys have a lot in common. And so I don't remember who was the curator. It might have been a guy from Glasshouse. But Amy and I played our first gig together, and we were like, wow, hi. she was the only, like, real flesh and blood person I knew who was doing something that was very like what I was doing. And yet Amy's work is really different than mine. Amy really is like a rock artist.
Well, she's really like, hard-edged, too, in a lot of places.
Her music is like, it's rock music. And she has some music that is more kind of classical music. But what I love about Amy's work is that it's unabashedly and unashamedly pop songs. But they're just in this really coming from another planet, and coming from this very intelligent place. But her way of constructing them and playing them is very related to my way of constructing and playing my pieces. We both were using loopers really heavily, but she was triggering hers with a MIDI cat, or like a drum cat. I think that was pre-cat days. It was like the Octopad or something like that. And I was using digital delays and foot switches to do mine. And then I was using actual physical found objects. And I think she does that too, but I don't think I ever saw her do that in the earlier days. But I know she has a couple of pieces. Like she has this one piece where she uses a toothbrush and actually, loops the sound of it brushing against her teeth. And so we were both doing very similar and very odd things. And we both have very different styles, but yet we both have classically trained voices. And we were just like, we have to play together. So we started, occasionally setting up gigs together and doing things together, and we've been friends ever since. And Amy's my age or a little younger than I am. Like, I think Amy was in school at Mills after I got out of school or something. But so she's a little bit younger than I am, but we're both kind of the same generation and kind of, simultaneously but separately we're doing – it's like not one, like everyone who knows us thinks that one of us heard the other one doing it and got the idea from her, but we both, completely unrelated to each other, got the idea of working the way we do. And it surprises me. I was always shocked that there weren't more people working that way. To me, it just seemed like such a natural thing to do. I couldn't understand why everyone didn't.
Which part of it was a natural thing to do?
To get like digital delays or some other kind of real-time looping device and build very structured pieces based on loops that you make in real time and, you know, then sing over the top of them and play over the top of them. There were some people who had like one or two pieces where they did that, but Amy and I are the only people I know really significantly in the world who just regularly, that's their main way that they work, you know? And so it's sort of like when I met her, it was almost sort of like, well, I was just wondering when this would happen, when I'd meet the other people who do this. And there are a lot of other people who do it, but I don't know many of them. Most of them aren't very well known. And I think as I've matured as an artist, I figured out that maybe the reason why more people don't do it is it's difficult to do it and not have it become very quickly my mouth won't say
cliched and self-conscious, both
cliched and self-conscious and boring.
Well, yeah,
you know, it's hard to do what Amy and I do and have it not get old quickly.
Quickly, that's the word.
Yes, and we'll have to ask Pamela to do a little bit of business for us again. Pamela.
Bonjour, je m'appelle Pamela Z.
Ciao.
Bonjour. And you're listening to Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar. Your red alert. Red alert.
Your red alert.
Your red alert. Alert for new music.
Here on WGDR 91.1 FM, Goddard College, Plainfield, Vermont.
Flagship of
the Non-Pop International Network.
There are too many words up there now.
Yeah, I know. It was so easy before that. Well, next week, Barry Schrader will be joining us. We should mention that now because we're going to squeeze in the rest of this interview as quickly as we can here. Our guest is Pamela Z, and what you've heard since the last hour as part of this interview, Badagada, Geek Speak, voice-activated questions in times of old and bone music. And she mentions, during the course of that last segment, she mentioned the work of Amy X. Newberg. And so we brought along a little bit of Amy X. Newberg, and we're going to hear My God, which we've heard before on the show. And I hope we can fit all of it in the time. But
you have the speed control.
I do have the speed control. I probably could do something about it that way. But let's just see what we hear. My God by Amy X. Newberg. And then we'll be back with the rest of the interview with Pamela Z. Z. Whatever.
Oh, Lord, turn not away thy face from him that lieth prostrate. Lamenting turns o'er his sinful ways before thy mercy's gate, which gates are opened wide to those that adore thy mercy's gate. Search not the gate. And crusted dishes all over the house. Piles of unopened mail and unrecycled recycling. Catalogs everywhere. Mac Zone, Mac Mall, Mac Connection, Mac Warehouse. Three copies of each. One to the house, one to the P.O. box, and one to a misspelling of my name. It's Newberg, by the way, with a U, Newberg. I've been thinking of dropping the last name altogether because no one ever spelled it right, and just going by Amy X. But then, even more people would ask me whether I practice Islam. 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 Practice. My God is drowning in the bath. My God is crackling in the bowl. My God is purple around the edges. My God is... hiding in a foxhole. You know how sometimes you walk into a room and you forget why you walked in there? Then you call it a senior moment, even though you've been doing it all your life? Well, the other day, this is a true story, the other day, I reached my hand out to do something, and I forgot what I was reaching out for. Food. 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 My God. Food. Trying to make milk out of powdered non-dairy creamer. Stale fig bars. Hummus, but no crackers. Very old carrots. Sardines. Bulb. Bulb is a frightening liqueur made from egg yolks. It sits on the shelf for years, and nothing bad ever happens to it.
Nothing bad ever happens to it. Nothing bad ever happens to it. Nothing bad ever happens to it. Nothing bad ever happens to it. Nothing bad ever happens to it. Nothing bad ever happens to it. Nothing bad.
My God is drowning in a bath. My God is crackling in a bowl. My God is circling around the edges. My God is hiding in a foxhole. I try to be productive during the day, but that precious time between when I finally get out of bed and when the daylight seems to be on its way out and it's time to get stoned again just keeps getting shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. 3 a.m. at the Safeway. Potato chips, liverwurst, laughing cows, and a single serving strawberry cheesecake. Surprising number of people here for 3 a.m. All looking at me. Everyone knows. And they smile behind their non-smile. I laugh inappropriately while sliding my Blue Cross card over and over through the ATM. The checkout clerk knows. She laughs too. Behind her, non. Laugh.
Ha, ha, ha.
By my own neuroses. I am entertained by everyone's neuroses. I am entertained by Antiques Roadshow. It doesn't take much. My God is drowning in the blood. My God is crackling in the bowl. My God is purple around the edges. My God is hiding in a foxhole. My cat died. I lost my favorite pair of glasses. Everyone got cancer and everyone else moved to Europe. Microsoft took a nosedive. Some idiots blew up the world. Whoops. I forgot to buy milk. I forgot to buy crackers. I forgot to have children. I forgot to set the alarm.
Amy X. Newberg from her CD Residue. That's called My God.
It goes on one of my, in my top 100.
I bet it does. And back to a person she occasionally works with, the guest today on Calvis and Damien, Pamela Z.
Zed.
But you're doing other things now. You've gone beyond looping vocal things because we see that you're writing a string quartet for Ethel. Is that correct?
But that's true.
So
that's true.
What process are you using for that?
Well, you know, I've written some chamber pieces before. I wrote a piece for the Bang on a Can All-Stars in 98. I think I was the first, or 98 or 99? 98, I think it was. Gosh, was it that long ago?
You know, you're going to age and just fall apart during this interview.
I already have. I mean, I probably got like, you know, seven new, most people get gray hairs, but I get blue hairs. My hair turns blue because
you're getting classical.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
But in any case, yeah. I did this commission for Bang Out of Can All Stars. It was a piece called The Schmetterling. And I think I was their first round of the People's Commissioning Fund. And I was one of three composers that they commissioned to do pieces for them. And so that was one of my first ones. I also did something the same year, I think, with the California Ear Unit. And I've done a piece for the Left Coast Chamber Ensemble. And then a couple years ago, I did a piece for the St. Luke's Chamber Ensemble. I wrote a piece for cello, solo cello, and electronics.
Had you done any other instrumental music before then? What gave them the confidence in you to write something other than a looping vocal piece?
I don't know. I just think they're nuts. I think they just threw caution to the wind, apparently. They said, maybe she could do this. And I'm not still convinced that I'm great at doing it, but what always comes out interesting, I mean, I really love the piece I made for Bang On Can All Stars, and I really hope someday that they'll record it. And I also wrote myself into the piece, so there was a part for voice and electronics amidst the other instrumentation. I believe the instrumentation was electric guitar, piano, cello, contrabass, percussion, and reeds. Evan Zaporn played, I don't remember whether I wrote for him to play clarinet. I think I wrote clarinet part for him. I wanted a saxophone part, but he said no, he didn't want to play the saxophone. So I said, I think I wrote a clarinet part for him, and then and sampler. And then voice with delays. So that was that piece. Back to your question, which is how do I go about doing it? The way that I went about doing that piece and the way that I did the cello piece for the St. Luke's Chamber Orchestra is I actually made something vocally and transcribed it.
Oh.
And then I also do a lot of, you know, I'm not much for sequencing. Like, I've never been a big MIDI sequencer type. I've never been big on that. The only way I tend to use MIDI on a regular basis is for triggering my samples in real time when I perform. But when I'm composing in the studio, I sometimes use MIDI so that I can actually play a melody or some kind of phrase on a MIDI instrument and record what that is that I'm playing.
Is that how you're writing the piece for the quartet for Ethel?
Yeah, and so when I write for Ethel, I believe the first ideas, sketches I've had have not even been notated or put down in any way, shape, or form yet in anything except me recording myself trying little things. But the way I will probably complete the score for them is at some point I will probably play the parts with a sampler using like a MIDI keyboard, and then I will, you know, use that so that I can actually hear it, what it sounds like on the instruments, to see if I like it. And then also I'll use that to pull the score out of it, because I so rarely write notated music that I'm terrible at it. And when I can write music, and I can actually, like, if I sang a melody for you right now, I could write down what it was, but I couldn't do it the way somebody who fluently, you know, notates does. I wouldn't be able to just go, ah, oh, here's the melody, and now let me just pick up a pencil and just sketch those notes down.
Yeah,
I'd have to sort of sing it a little bit and go, okay, what's that? Okay, that's this. Okay, now let me just, I have to count here, because let me get, what is that rhythm? You know, and it takes me a while. It takes me a really long time to transcribe, because I'm slow at it because I never do it. And I very rarely read, so I'm very slow at sight reading. So I transcribe it between, like, writing it down by hand, little parts as they come to me, or playing them into a MIDI thing and then taking the MIDI file and turning it into music and then fixing it because it's wrong. And then once I'm done and I have, like, the whole thing done, I hire a friend of mine who's really good at doing scores to help me make it look pretty. And I get somebody who's really good in Finale or Sibelius, and they help me, and they help me to generate the parts, because if I did it, you know, the string quartet would look at it and say, why are the stems going this way? Or why did you break it up that way on the page?
And why are those note heads made like little ducks?
Yeah, why is it, and I can't read this. But, yeah, so that's how I work when I do stuff for chamber musicians.
So it sounds like kind of an arch of transition is going on here. Do you have a kind of a view of where you're headed?
Well, I always have this slow dovetailing kinds of activities going on in my life. Like when I first started doing stuff with voice and electronics, I was still throwing in a few singer-songwriter type songs. And by the time those singer-songwriter songs had faded away, I was not only doing performances for voice and electronics, but I was also inserting, you know, like sampled sounds other than my own voice, and projected images into my work and making more sort of like interdisciplinary kind of performance things. And then at some point, as I was crossing over into that territory, I also became interested in making radio pieces, which was harkening way back to my childhood when I used to make fake radio pieces. But I call them fake radio pieces. I don't know why they're fake. I mean, they never were played on the radio, but... And they weren't commissioned by Helen Thorington or Calvos and Damien or This American Life or the Third Coast Sound Art Festival or something. But in more recent years, I started making sort of sound pieces that were, you know, not for me to perform, but that would get played either in an installation or just on the radio. And doing film scores and sound design for things, you know. And now, like in the last couple of years, I've become really interested in working with multi-channel things. And the first piece I did like that was because, you know, Tom Steenland at Starkland Records commissioned 12 composers. Was it 12 or 13? 12 or 13 of us were commissioned to do pieces that were specifically for DVD audio 5.1 surround.
Uh-huh, yep.
And I did that, and I was like, ooh, that's fun. I want to make installations that are meant to be coming out of multiple speakers. Right. And so then I, you know, it seems like, you know, when you start to get interested in things, somehow something hooks into the ether and the rest of the world. Yeah, things are coming to you that are related to that. Like, I started just out of the blue getting commissions to make sound pieces. And I've made several sound pieces that have been commissioned by and exhibited in galleries since the time that I did that thing for Tom. So that's sort of a direction for me. And then also in recent years, these chamber music commissions have come up for me, and I really like that. So I try not to be really rigid. I'm really interested in kind of going whatever direction it interests me at the time. I don't want to just stagnate into doing one thing. But on the other hand, too, I think I'm getting a little worn out because my pace has always been like too frenetic. I always have way too many projects going on. And so one of these days I'm going to have to, like, try to learn to pick and choose a little more. Because my tendency is...
We asked you, some of the things about yourself and sort of diverting the topic here, but we're kind of running out of time. Mm-hmm. So I'd really like to know why you love people being forced to listen to bad music and hate tiny dogs in sweaters.
Oh, but I don't love people being forced to listen to... Oh, I see. You turned it around just to be subversive, didn't you? I think that I tiny dogs in sweaters make me laugh. That was the answer to your question of what makes me laugh.
Yes.
And tiny dogs in sweaters is one of the things that makes me laugh.
I saw an excellent
tiny dog in a sweater yesterday. I swear to God, it was like a teacup, you know, breed of something. It was so small. It really looked more rodent-like than dog-like.
It was an Oscar Mayer.
It wasn't a dachshund. It was like more kind of Chihuahua-esque. But this one was so small. It was just this tiny little runty thing with little feet. It really looked like a cartoon drawing of a tiny dog. And the woman had it on a leash, and she had knitted. I could tell that either she or maybe her child or someone had knitted the sweater that it was wearing.
You sure it wasn't like a kite? Then the wind wasn't blowing.
No, it was earthbound.
Okay. All right.
But yeah. No, being forced to listen to music, I hate being forced to listen to particularly bad pop music.
You mean like elevators or
no,
bad pop
I mean,
music
at this
on the
point,
radio?
I actually think that, I mean, I used to think that the world's worst music was sort of Muzak, elevator music, but now I think I've changed my mind about that. Elevator music at its best can have a certain level of you know, sort of kitsch chic to it. But what I really hate is like that the really bad like power anthem rock music that you know, or really bad like jazz fusion pop music, or really or like the other pet peeve I have, and this is going to turn a lot of people against me, I know, but reggae. I'm sorry, like just too much reggae, and I have been plagued with having neighbors that like to play these things at high volume. And I don't mind noise. Like, I totally don't mind, like, construction noises outdoors or, like, you know, people working with machines in the street or, like, the sounds of people actually working. I like that. But I hate being forced to listen to somebody else's choice of music. And I think the reason why is even though I'm sort of in the unpop camp in terms of the music that I do, I am not against popular music. I actually like popular music, but I am way more picky about pop music than I am about other kinds of music. I'm much more picky. Like, if I don't like pop music, I tend to kind of hate it. And I only like the ones I like. So I tend to really hate it when other people force me to listen to theirs because it wouldn't have been my choice. That's just a little pet peeve of mine.
You
stand out.
You
started laughing.
You
started me dreaming.
You
started something.
You
started something.
You
stayed away too long.
You
stayed on my mind.
You
stepped into my life.
You
stepped out of a dream.
You
stepped out of a dream.
You
stepped out of a dream.
You
still get to me.
You
still got it.
You
still move me.
You
still want me.
You
stole my heart.
You
stopped loving me.
You
sure got this old redneck feeling blue.
You
sure know how to party.
You
sure know how to use the things you use.
You
sure love to ball.
You
sure make cheating seem easy.
You
sure tell it like it is, George Jones.
You
take a little bit of it home.
You
take me for granted.
You
take me to heaven.
You
take me up.
You
take my breath away.
You
take my breath away.
You
take my heart away.
You
take my heart home with you.
You
take my heart home with you one piece at a time.
You
talk just like my mom.
You
talk that talk.
You
talk too much.
You
talk too much.
You
talk too much.
You
taught me to love again.
You
taught my heart to sing.
You
tear me up.
You
tell him, Ivory.
You
tell me.
You
tell me.
You
tell me.
You
tell me that I'm falling down.
You
tell me why.
You
tell me your dream, I'll tell you mine.
You,
the night and the music.
You
think I still care.
You
think I'm crazy.
You
think you're tough.
You
thought.
You
threw your love on me too strong.
You
thrill me.
You
told him.
You
told me.
You
told me, baby.
You
told me you care.
You
too.
You
too.
You
took advantage of me.
You
took advantage of me.
You
took all the rambling out of me.
You
took everything but me.
You
took her off my hands.
You
took me all the way.
You
took me in the name of love.
You
took my heart.
You
took my heart away.
You
took my heart by surprise.
You
took my life away.
You
took my love.
You
took my money.
You
took the best part of me.
You
took the words right out of my heart.
You
took the words right out of my mouth.
You
touched my life.
You
touched my life.
You.
you, 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 you.
Well, we're pretty much out of time for today's show, and why don't you make a real provocative statement and something sort of noisy for us, and then we can play some more of your stuff.
A provocative statement.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of provocation in your pieces, mm-hmm. or do you reserve the provocation for that?
Well, let me see. What can I say that's provocative? My Damien.
Huh?
Those are lovely thighs you have.
Thanks.
And I can't even see them. Was that provocative enough?
It was.
Or I could go with
insightful.
The old Monty Python. Excuse me, please may I fondle your thighs?
The bum! The bum!
That was me trying to be provocative. Sorry.
Oh, well. We'll leave it to the music for that.
Yeah, that went over like a Led Zeppelin.
A lead thigh.
A lead thigh. Thighs. I just thought I'd say it again. All right. And then,
yes.
We'll
just come our way over to the thanks for joining us on Calvus and Damien part.
Oh, hi.
Well, thanks. It's been a real treat.
And it's been the same. The pleasure has all been mine.
Mm-hmm. And ours.
All right. Well, my counter reads 62 minutes and 45 seconds.
And mine reads 64 minutes and 34 seconds, but we may have pressed the buttons at different times to start with. So
I think
I'll
we did.
I'll sync them up when we get this CD from you, so that'd be great.
All right. Thanks so much.
I hope we covered everything.
I hope so, too.
Thanks a lot. Have a great wedding.
Thanks. Bye.
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 Pamela Z. There
Someone
she
say
was.
We covered too much.
Yes, we covered too much. Well, anyway, next week, Barry Schrader will tell you all about the Composer Combat for September 17th. You're listening a little bit about Barry Schrader right now, and we'll see you then. A production of Multimedia.